Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to another edition of the El Arpa podcast. Mary, careful there with the microphone. How are you? And again, it's like it's covered in fish oil or something and you have wet hands. You're from the north, aren't you? I thought your people would be comfortable with slimy things jumping around.
That's it. It's okay. It's been fixed.
Okay, fair enough then. Just in case.
I'm very well. Did you ask me?
I did ask you that, yeah. In case people think I was being pejorative against northerners, I meant because like fishermen, not because they have a habit. Anyway, forget about it.
No,
let's just move on. Okay, so you had your first tour of the Faroe exhibition yesterday.
Yes.
Which you've spoken on a previous podcast, a couple actually, but more in depth in one. And it went quite well.
It went quite well.
Yeah, so your favourite part was an arch. And people arched their eyebrows when you mentioned that.
Well, I don't know. There were three things that I said were my favourite pieces, but they're not like the most, they're not the flashiest in the exhibition, so they were probably quite surprised about it.
And you got some compliments at the end as well.
Well, just thank you, Sam. They say they liked it.
That's good. I'm very proud of you.
Thank you.
Also, people on this tour had auriculares. They had headphones. So how was it like? What was it like giving a tour in the future?
In the future?
Yeah, very all the Balkans.
No, well, it's a great idea. I mean, I love doing it like that because literally I just walk around and then I'm talking and I just have to talk at a normal level and then they hear me all right. There's no need for shouting. So like when you're doing a normal tour, you really have to raise your voice. And because we know I naturally have a very quiet voice that all the time I have to make an effort to.
Yeah.
Or you have to sometimes run it through. And all,
yeah, I know, but sometimes I try and provoke you, make you angry, so you do shout, so we can actually have a normal
conversation. I know, it's the story of my life.
But fair play, well done. And when is your next tour?
The 1st of December.
Oh, wow. Christmas, magical month. Also as well, we were talking a little bit off air as well. Someone who shall remain nameless, I had cast furious doubts over certain things in ancient Egypt and then the spread of early humans. I won't go into any more detail because you know who you are if you're listening to this. I will spare your blushes. But essentially, it kind of got me thinking though, and I actually started listening to a podcast about DNA. And one thing I've noticed about American podcasts, which is hilarious, is that they don't know how to react to jokes.
How come?
Well, for example, they had a guy who's an expert in his field, obviously, and he was like making some allusions without any attempt at humor, really. But he's like saying, well, about the distribution of genes and what we inherit. Well, it's all chances anyway and probability because we might get something advantageous, but if it's in a Catholic nun, then it's pointless, you know? So while some things do get passed on, other good things don't get passed on. So it's not always like Darwinian in terms of, this is very useful, so we'll keep this, you know? So that was kind of like what he was saying. Well, obviously, if it's a Catholic nun, she's not going to be reproducing anytime soon. But then he was like, oh, well, I'll have to remember that next time we're talking about this. I'll tell people that it's like a Catholic nun because I wouldn't have said it like that myself. But that was a good one. Or more or less. I'll paraphrase it. You seem like a nice guy, to be fair to the host, but it's just like they're always uncomfortable or always the jokes are very forced, very, very rehearsed. I think they're reading off a piece of paper. And if someone comes in with a, I don't know, like chaos, to use chaos theory, an unknown, unplanned, non-pre-planned joke. So I was like, we have to acknowledge it. We have to move on because it's dangerous. We can't stay too long on it, you know. But it was a good podcast though.
Do you think that's why most of our listeners are from the US?
Because we had like like unscripted?
Because we have spontaneous humor.
It's spontaneous anyway, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Good, bad, or indifferent. Mm. No, they're good podcasts, but in general, American ones, but they're just, interestingly enough, they have a particular style.
Mm.
I don't know why that is. But then again, podcasts, but you know, that being said, you know, Bill Burr is an American and he's one of the biggest podcasts out there probably. And he's just completely not like that. It's just he's a comedian. So he's just always riffing, going with the flow. And he'll even break the fourth wall and say, how much time left? Ugh, I'm contractually obliged to do a half an hour of this. So 10 more minutes, see if I can eat up some time. And he'll go on Google or the internet to try and kill the time. And yet we listen. So I didn't.
We would never do that.
No, we wouldn't. As we craftily check how much time is left in part one. But Joe Rogan's another one as well. Who he's kind of okay. He's hit or miss. But I saw a recent thing. Actually, this morning, actually, to be true, because there's a guy in SNL who was making fun of a Republican politician who had his only one eye because he's been injured in combat, basically in Iraq. But the whole point of the skit, which I actually haven't seen myself, but based on what I've read around it, it was like he was so ignorant. He was just judging the candidates on their looks, basically. So this guy had an eye patch, so he was just riffing on that, you know. Now, not having seen the sketch, I can't say whether it's appropriate or not. But he also makes jokes about his own father, who passed away in 9/11 as well. So I think nothing's off target for him. And if he's going after his own family like that, well, not going after, but if he's riffing on that, then you can kind of see that, you know, it's not politically motivated. While Joe Rogan, I think, was trying to say like, oh, you know, like they don't care making these jokes because they're Republicans that they're targeting, you know, and then the kind of the bias the left wing media has for the right wing politicians is like insane or kind of strange. Just kind of leave it hanging in the air. They don't really kind of like analyze it or go into any detail, but it's left there like a bad smell. I know a lot of his listenership will be thinking, oh, yeah, left media, liberal media, oh, they're so biased, you know, and just feeding into this thing where I think maybe sometimes you do have the left wing media who do kind of pursue biased channels of news. But again, you know, based on our perspective, yes, based on my perspective, it's not nowhere near as bad as what the Republicans do when they're talking about the left or people on the left. You know, I mean, even if you see how many times they spoke about the caravan before the midterm elections, it was quite frequently during episodes of, for example, Fox and Friends. And then afterwards, they mentioned it once after the election. So I think, I went off on a tangent here about the different American podcasts, but Joe Rogan is generally good and he doesn't fall into that trap of it feeling staged. It's very dynamic. He's authentic, which is very important. But I didn't really like that so much, that kind of segment I saw today and heard today, where, I don't know, but that's the beauty of podcast though, I guess, because you don't have to agree with everything, you know, but at least it's authentic, I think. I mean, I think he probably really does believe that, rather than other ones, which are a bit more, not inauthentic, but a bit more rigid, I guess, in, they're so overly produced, you don't have a lot of personality shining through, even though the people who you're listening to seem like nice guys or whatever, nice people and informative, and you'd happily listen to them. So it's not taking away from the podcast too much, but it's definitely noticeable in comparison to other styles of the show. So I don't know. And anyway, speaking of DNA thing, I did find some interesting things, which is interesting. That's what are interesting things. do you know how much of our DNA is actually junk DNA?
Junk, like useless.
Useless.
Probably, I have no idea.
You probably have no idea, or you don't have any idea.
No, you don't know. I don't know.
75%.
75% is useless. Yeah. I was going to say I had a figure like that, but I thought it was probably wrong.
We've been invaded by viruses and bacteria and everything as well. So a lot of our DNA matter is like of foreign bodies or foreign species, which is kind of incredible. There's a few things that like we're known as a primary species because we have a certain sequence of proteins that like, for example, a cat or a dog doesn't have, but chimps would have it as well. But, you know, on the other hand, dogs, for example, can produce their own vitamin C. And the sequence that we used to have to kind of generate that in ourselves, we don't have it anymore. It's been broken or it's been lost. Even though it's still there, it doesn't have any functionality. So this kind of goes to show how the probability stakes works in you know, things being inherited, and sometimes things that are nominally beneficial don't always make it true for whatever reason, because there's so many things going on. It's an incredible process, you know.
But it's all too complicated for me, like, humanity through and through, so...
Yeah, well, me too.
The whole concept is quite complicated to grasp.
Well, one thing I did mention to you before as well, is like, they said, like, if we had 100% functionality in our genes, essentially, we'd have to have a lot more children, like 3,000 per person or something like that, to make sure they survived or whatever. Because, like, the more does not always equal good. So if it's, like, 70, if it's 25% functionality, that means, like, it can work a lot more efficiently. But they use the example of a technological gadget, which has fewer small working parts. So if you have like a basic, maybe Casio watch or something like that, or maybe a hammer is the example that they use. If it's a one-part hammer, it's going to last forever and ever and ever. If it's a two-part hammer, it's still going to be pretty good, but it's going to be have less longevity than the hammer. It's just a hammer It's in one shape, you know, it's not like two parts connected together. And, but like something that's more complicated, I don't know, like an engine or a car or whatever is going to, because there's so many more working parts, there's more potential for things to go wrong and they don't last as long as well. So in fact, even though it sounds like a bit strange, and there is one plant in particular, which has actually has a more complex genome than us. But you know, you'd assume, oh, that's probably a good thing, no? But actually, no. This planet is not special, doesn't even have a common name. And while us human beings, we have 25% functionality in our genome, but we are, we're human beings, no? We are masters of our domain, masters of the earth. So I don't know, it's kind of interesting. But I'm also of humanities as well, so that's why I took notes while listening to the podcast. So anyway, before we move to part two, surely there might be something else you want to say. No? Okay, see? This is unscriptedness in progress. It's beautiful. So we'll move on gingerly to part two, and you can join us for more talk about cultural things, focusing specifically on an exhibition we saw, and also the work of Jack Kerouac. So welcome to part two of the show.
Welcome. Good.
Yeah, welcome. You're going to make a funny comment again.
No, because like you're censuring me.
I was. And you never know why, listener. Anyway, so where will we start? Will we start with the exhibition or will we start with Jack Kerouac?
Well, we can start with the exhibition because we're going to slag it off as usual.
Not slag it off. It would be nice. But you dragged me to it. So what was the name and the purpose of the exhibition?
I didn't drag you to it. You came quite willingly. It was about the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah.
And
I was always arrogant. You're like, about the Mediterranean.
No, Mediterranean. Yes. To be honest, I thought it was like in general about the Mediterranean in paintings. But it was mostly focused on basically the turn of the century, or the 20th century, where there was a whole lot of artists that focused on a certain vision of what the Mediterranean is, and kind of like focused on France. Not very Mediterranean. Like marginally compared to...
Well, the South Coast, no, specifically.
Yes, but I mean, yeah, compared to Spain or Italy or...
Yeah.
I'm being really bad here. But yeah, there was Spain, Italy, and...
It's kind of interesting to see this French-Spanish rivalry.
No, but I don't know. It was meant to be... Well, it was just a series painters, of artists that kind of like focused on it. And you made an interesting point that they sort of focused very much on like a classicist... version of it. So they focus very much on like Rome and Greece, but
Well, yeah.
To bring back some ideals from...
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't set in those times. World. It was set in their contemporary times, but, yes, but, yes, but definitely with a nod towards Greek or Roman things. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's from what they described in the abstract about an awoken Mediterranean consciousness. It's very intriguing because traditionally, I would imagine that it's a part of Europe that was looked down upon and frowned upon by Northerners in those countries. Well, I mean, especially in Italy as well, but even like in the rest of Europe as well. And then to have these other painters seeking out Mediterranean themes and locations is quite a rupture from the previous way of looking at it. So that is a very intriguing supposition or idea. Mm. But yeah, I guess if you like cubism, you like it. But for me, I don't really like it that much. But also they have just pastoral scenes and just people kind of sitting around and it's human form and all that as well. But it didn't seem to be very Mediterranean. I don't know. I guess they could have invoked something else.
No, and also like it was based on that time, as you say.
Yeah.
But many things, I mean, we talked about like Sorolla and about how a lot of the famous Spanish painter who focuses a lot on light around the sea, but also on the people that, you know, fishermen and fisherwomen and just the kids and everybody who's around. So that gave you an idea of life in the Mediterranean. But other paintings could have been anywhere, in fairness.
And we're with fair weather. Very flat as well and a little bit, didn't really catch your eye. Like, I mean, once we turned the corner and saw those pictures, it was obvious immediately there were two Sorolla paintings there.
Yes, of course.
Because the master of light was making the light dance. It sounds very pretentious, but the light was very...
there was a moment of silence there.
It was cringy. But there's two kids bathing in the sea.
Hmm.
And then another picture, there are two teenagers walking towards the sea, or maybe they're a little bit younger. And then another with a woman who's like unfurling a blanket.
Hmm.
And by God, the light danced on that blanket.
It's quite beautiful.
It was nice because it really shone... In comparison to most paintings, really, because...
Literally.
Literally, yes, because that was his thing, you know, and not a lot of painters did that. But just in comparison to one specifically there, a lot of them were very kind of muddy and earthy and a little bit, I guess, bland, you could say, as well.
Waxy
as well. Like, I think, you know, I think when we, like, go back to the Margaret Spencer photography exhibition that we spoke about in another podcast, a lot of these things, she was the mother of Virginia Woolf. You remember?
No.
Cameron Spencer?
I think it was Margaret Cameron.
Margaret Cameron, that's the one. See?
Okay. Well, close enough.
Yeah. See, we dovetailed nicely. You're the details. I'm the feeling. Anyway, so she like it did like lots
the light
of...
was dancing.
Hey, that's what I was thinking of, yeah. But, a lot of our photographs were very staged as well. And I thought that they were diminished because of that. And those ones where you have people sitting around or nominally pastoral scenes are also very staged, while these scenes of his family are authentic because they're of his family, but they're just people doing what you do at the seaside and everything as well. So apart from the technique, which I think was obviously better, I would venture to say, maybe that would be the wrong thing to say, but for me it was better. The technique of Sorolla in comparison to the other ones there, but also just what he was capturing was just a bit more illuminating, and also just kind of grabbed your attention a bit more. So those were amazing pieces. Also, there's a Van Gogh there, which was beautiful because it was of gypsies and a few caravans, but. You know, this obviously is in a way the anti-Sorolla and more similar to the other pieces there. But as soon as I turned the corner, I saw it. I was like, for me, it's a Van Gogh straight away. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen this painting before, but I just knew by the style and whatever it is that's in that painting. But just it just spoke to me. It was appealing. And it's a very beautiful piece as well. And
if it was really tiny in comparison to others.
It's incredible because like we've discovered this video that we're going to use in class about this Google project that captures with a lot of polygons pictures all over the world and recreates exhibition centers and museums and everything. And they're talking about Van Gogh. You can zoom in so closely and not lose any of the detail and see all his brush strokes and where he cut the canvas and see his paintings in a new way, you know. And even with this painting, you don't have that technology because you're right in front of it, but you can see again just how he cut the canvas and how he, you know, it's rough, but it's rough in a different way to the other paintings that we didn't like so much there. And also, there's another one, I think is it a Monet maybe? Where he focuses in like super zooming in the video of a TED talk, and you can see like these boys playing a game where they're like hitting a goose, and when you zoom back out again, it's like barely noticeable in the actual landscape of the painting. So like the way you mentioned that, it's a tiny painting and there's a lot of tiny details in the background as well. There's so much going on sometimes that that have never really been seen before, probably in paintings, until we apply new technologies to them. But there's also another painting I did quite like. It was a bit more modern. It's of a couple on a beach. It was kind of like of its time because they're kind of cube-like figures. But it kind of reminded me of the Great Gatsby, and it evoked people who were rich having a good time at the beach. And it kind of said something, I think, a little bit more than the rest of them. But I will allow you to say something as well, so I don't dominate too much.
No, but I agree. I mean, we mentioned Ava Sorolla when we were there, and really there was very little else that spoke to me. And it's quite unusual because, I mean, well, being born in Spain, you would have thought like I'm more familiar with the Mediterranean, so it wouldn't be like quite hard to have things that evoke it, you know what I mean? But there weren't very many things that actually, but perhaps because of what we were saying, that it drew on like classical themes or whatever, and it was more like an imagined version of the river, of the sea than the reality, because it wasn't, for example, I don't know, there was more authenticity in this painting. I can't remember what it's called in English, but People Bathing or...
People Bathing, yeah.
It's like... okay. It's like... it's also done with a technique of like the points.
Yeah.
And it's like the riverside, the Paris riverside.
Are you talking about Sorolla still, yeah?
No.
Oh, yeah, because there's we mentioned about Sorolla as well, where there's no expressions on their faces. You remember that as well? It's like it's sun-dappled.
Yeah.
We're kind of theorizing about that as well. Maybe the sun's in our eyes as the viewer, that we're kind of looking at that and we can't see.
Yes. No, completely unrelated to that. In fact, this painting wasn't at the exhibition. I was just going to say by comparison that this other one that has like, it's one like with a dog, and I don't know if it's Manet. I'm not quite sure.
You're doing this in the car as well. You're like, I turned to talk to you about Spike Lee and you're talking about Guy Ritchie.
Okay, yeah. But the listeners are going to get completely confused.
Yeah.
But there's like a dog and there's like a big umbrella and people
sunbathing. Yeah.
And you don't know which one it is?
Not at the top of my head, no.
Okay. Well, anyway, that one really portrays like...
But it's Impressionism.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And really portrays like life, like next to the river, so like where there's a lot of people and, you know, there's a bit of an atmosphere. And for example, very precise of that time. And for example, that's what I was missing in these other paintings. That's the point I was trying to make.
Oh, no, I think that's very true, because very like ethical. What you have is those people in their normal clothes doing their normal things, while because this is timeless, it could be, as you said, anywhere or with anybody. There's nothing that's particularly Mediterranean about it. Excuse me. And like if you're doing that to recapture the Mediterranean spirit, really what you're doing is just rehashing Greek or Roman forms, because like there's nobody wearing contemporary clothing, there's nobody doing contemporary things.
There's nobody wearing clothes, full stop.
That's true. So if you like that kind of thing, do pop a log. But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, it's fine. It's grand. I mean, there's nothing objectionable about any of it. There's nothing like so bad about the paintings. And
no,
you know,
it just wasn't particularly inspiring.
No, not particularly. But you know, it's always nice to see a Sorolla, and it's always nice to see a Van Gogh as well. and a few other interesting ones there. But all in all, not bad. It's okay. Fondation Mapfre. What's the name of the street?
Well, it's in Recoletos.
Exactly. So if you're in town, it is free. And the gift shop there is on Mondays. Okay.
Only on Mondays.
The gift shop there is pretty extensive as well.
That's where we went today.
Really? Ah, okay.
It is.
Very nice. Okay. Well, anything else you want to say about this exhibition?
No, I think we can move on to your book.
Okay. Well, dear Mary, it's not my book. It's Jack Kerouac's book.
Okay. That you borrowed from him.
That I bought from Fnac. So Jack Kerouac, Satori in Paris. There's actually a lot of things we can say about this. So I'll give a brief introduction. I'll ask you some specific questions so I don't go rabbiting on for too long. And then I'll kind of pull it back into my impressions of the book. Okay. And we'll probably go to part three then.
Okay.
And then we'll have a cup of tea afterwards. Sounds good, no? Well, it's called Satori in Paris. And now this book was built... well, Satori is like a word for awakening. It's a Buddhist principle.
All right, okay.
So his awakening happens in Paris. And they talk about it here, for example.
When you say you bought it, I thought it was Safari.
I said Safari in WhatsApp. And then I looked at the book after I sent the message. And I was like, oh, got that wrong.
Oh, it was Safari.
But they say at the back of the book, at the blurb, published at the height of his fame, Satori in Paris is a hectic tale of philosophy, identity, and the powerful strangeness of travel. Now, I like this book. I really do. But I don't see much philosophy in it or identity. Strangely enough, actually. Even though, in terms of identity, it is there and it isn't. And in the strangeness of travel, I think is the most powerful element of the book. So what it is a semi-autobiographical novel by Kerouac, which isn't strange to him. He was willing to dip his pen in that inkwell of kind of creating fiction out of his own personal life and everything, because he was part of that Beat generation. He was friends with Ginsberg and those boyos, and like the Guardian quote at the back talks about him having a remarkable ear for the cadences of a phrase or sentence, a sense of how to register in words the sheer sweet flow of things. And flow is the key word, I think, in that part, because what he seems to have mastered, well, has mastered, is this idea of like taking a moment and just writing about it. Taking in everything that mean what that moment means for him and those references. So and sometimes you can get lost in that. I mean, for example, if he was with us today and went to the exhibition, he might see a wall that remind him of New York or America when he was sitting on a wall with a friend sharing a beer, swapping baseball cards, kind of thing, you know. So he'd build this kind of flow of structure and story built around that. And you don't know necessarily who all these characters are or where, like what he's exactly talking about. Because when you are writing a story based on something personal like that, it's fitting into an inner narrative or an inner philosophy, it should be said. But normally when you're writing about it, you fill in those blanks and you explain that. But what he's doing is just kind of flowing from his brain, those sensations. And while it's like a white water river, you're kind of going everywhere at once, and sometimes you get lost and submerged in all the words that are spelt in a colloquial way or just spring up out of nowhere, or there'll be a reference to like a French writer popping up and then popping back down again. So it's kind of like you just dive into it and you read the story and you get your bearings pretty quickly and easily, but there'll be a lot of chapters where you're not understanding everything, but you kind of understand what it means, which I think is also life and conversation as well, because a lot of the time, I guess, you don't know what a person is truly saying to you. Pretentious alert. But you do get a sensation. So I think, Gabriel Garcia Marquez spoke about life happening with the things that you remember from it, you know, so like your living comes from remembering things that you've done. I think his life is coming from the sensations and, again, the memories that he has as well, which are both real and imagined in the sense of, well, I guess they are real as well, but imagined in the sense of literary metaphors and books that he's read, like things like Baudelaire or whatever. He just, like, that'll mean something for him if he's, like, asking for directions. And then he'll think of Baudelaire asking for directions. And it doesn't mean anything. But then again, you know, it's part of that story, this kind of narrative, of which kind of mirrors what he's doing in Paris. Now, what is he doing in Paris? Which is the kind of more coherent part of the story is that he has French ancestry and he's come to Paris to go to libraries to find evidence of that, or to find, well, not evidence of it, he knows it's true, but just to find documents so he can trace his family tree, basically. And that part I'll ask you about in a moment as well. That's the story. And in fact, there is a chapter called The Chapter That Makes No Sense, which ironically makes the most sense of all the chapters. Now, The Stranger to Travel is, as I said, the most interesting part of the book for me. I'm on page 83. There's 103 pages in the book, so there's like 20 pages left. So, like, he speaks French because he, like, grew up a French Canadian. So he speaks with an accent. And there are certain characters or moments in the book where you can really recognize them. For example, he's sitting in a bar in Paris on his own, and he's drinking, which is a frequent occurrence in the story. And he sometimes even just like he says, it just pops up. Oh, I wish I was in Dublin getting drunk with Peter O'Toole. Or like he'll describe a French woman as having an Irish haughtiness. And then I realized I was being haughtier than her. And again, I don't know what he's talking about when it comes to the Irish things, because just they come out of nowhere as well. But he notices another American who's looking completely annoyed and frustrated because nobody understands him. Presumably, that's what he's imagining. Kerouac, probably somebody back in New York told him, "Oh, go to Paris, beautiful man, you're gonna love it." And then, like, he went over there, didn't like the food, nobody understood him, and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, and he was imagining that, which I think can happen, where someone's sold an idea of something, or because they're not capable of surviving when they don't speak the language, then they have this horrendous time. They go back home, meet the boys in the bar, and go, "Oh, thank God I'm home." And then they'll spend the rest of their days cursing their trip to Paris, for example. Another time as well is these two women who are like sisters, I think, who are traveling, and they are also can't speak French, and they're fumbling for change, and they're like, "Oh, we want this and this for breakfast," and they're pointing at everything, and then Kerouac notices that they get the correct change. So even though, like, you know, it was an opportunity perhaps for somebody to swindle them a little bit, that didn't happen. They were like, made it misunderstood very badly, but the cafe owner was able to give them what they wanted and everything. So, which, again, I was thinking today, what it is, you know, it's kind of a wild ride and fantastical. What it is, in a beautiful way, is also a celebration of the banality of travel, like walking the streets, asking directions, being suspicious of the directions that you get. For whatever reason, he feels like, "Oh, they've given me bad directions here. They're trying to screw me," or something like that, you know. He actually gives out to the French for not wanting to speak French to him, and also giving, like, not wanting to give him directions. And it's just like, I think some people might have a stereotype of that as well. Like, if you ask somebody in Paris help, you know, Paris, even for French people, isn't seen as a very friendly city. Now, I've been there, and I had a very nice time. People were very nice there, but that would be the stereotype that, again, he either experienced or he's cashing in on and telling the story that again, for us would be recognizable as a concept or as an idea. Another thing that he could talk about is that, well, there's another night he's in a bar and he just starts talking to a stranger, and like they're talking in French, and he just loves the fact that he's having this conversation in France in French. And he's like, other people are kind of half listening, half amused. And it's an incredible thing, because as this person who speaks a second language, as we both are, you better than me, of course, that kind of moments of being able to do that is a magical moment. And also as well, like, he has this thing where he's like traveling alone, and sometimes he feels lonely, and he starts talking to the bar owner, and then after half an hour they get tired of him, and he's like, "Oh, I've ruined this bar, I can never come back here again." So it's just this kind of guy who's just going from bar to bar in a way as well. And like he's on this train, and the train part is interesting, because there's two old women, a soldier, a guy who looks Irish apparently, and like keeps giving him looks as in like, "Come on, let's just go drinking," and they eventually do. And a thin priest, and he's like trying to like make a conversation with him, I'm Catholic too, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And then they go drinking, he comes back and he goes, "I think this is my moment of safari."
Satori,
exactly. Okay. Awakening. And it's just like, really? This is very anticlimactic, because he basically says, he has this conversation about how the church wants to keep the poor poor and the rich rich and all that kind of thing. And, you know, they say in the back of the book, these kind of like, these conversations about life and philosophy in bars and trains of Paris and France and everything. But I don't know, it sounds like the kind of drunken ramblings as well, but guys, it's like the church are just, you know, this, you know, no say gay, you know. And then he goes, and he ends up going to the north of France anyway. And that's just that's part of the story that I'm at the moment. But there at 3 o'clock in the morning, he's like wandering around the city completely lost with no place to stay. And again, it's just kind of like these things. It's like looking for directions and asking for a light. Now he finds a hotel where somebody like knows like someone he could be related to that has the same family name. And then he tells a dirty joke in front of everybody and they all start laughing. But it's like this guy rings his brother, who rings somebody else, who rings somebody else. And it's all these kind of like coincidences and occasions that do happen when you're traveling. And that, I think, more than anything else, more than the identity, even though the identity is very important in terms of him searching for his legacy or his the people that came before him, his ancestors, that is obviously a fundamental part of the book. But the strangeness of travel, the banality of it, the kind of incidences and the incidental things probably are what are the best part of the book, at least for me, even though a lot of people would say it's the style of writing, which is interesting as well. But for me, wouldn't be the most interesting part, even though it is good, though, you know. So okay. Yeah, I don't know.
There's a lot of stuff into that.
Yeah, but look, one thing is like he's looking for information in French libraries, and they don't want to give him any information. And then when I was reading the book about the English journalist in Russia researching this Russian priest, like again, because they did not want to help him. And I don't know if it's because he's a foreigner or because libraries are always like that. But your input in this will be very interesting because you have ample experience of going to libraries all over the world.
Well, all over the world. But, well, I don't know. I suppose the experience sometimes is that they sort of like wonder like why you want to read anything. I don't know. That's the feeling I get. Like, you know, why would you want to read anything in our language type of thing?
Well, he's very dismissive of... one library in Paris, he said, like, the scholars, in inverted commas, copying things from books, you know, as in they're not doing any research or anything new, while he wants to actually go and read something that's important for him, you know, and they won't let him, you know, they're suspicious of him. But then again, he just says in another line, well, I smelled the drink, so they probably were smelling that as well. So it's like there's all these other things coming, but I don't know.
I think there's like a traditional vision of a library, and now... They're making a big effort to make it more participative and having activities and things like that, and not as you know, closed as before, that it almost looked like they were the custodians of books or whatever, and you were bothering them.
Yeah,
some of them, of course, not all.
I wonder, is that a classism of books then, of learning, that, you know, it becomes stratified, we deserve to learn this, but you don't deserve to learn any of this?
No, I don't know. I think, I don't know. To be honest, I remember taking part in competitions when I was little at my local library. So I can't lose anything about my local library.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing though. Like, these are like local libraries, and you have like national archives or big libraries.
Of course, if it's talking about the national library, then there's like it's kind of like a big obstacle career to race to try and get in. Yeah, like they make it as difficult as they can, having been to, you know, a number of like national libraries for research. It's kind of like, well, I don't know, you have to spare a couple of hours just to get in while you're leaving stuff and then requesting that they bring you a book and all this.
Yeah it's a slow process.
It is.
Well, poor Mary and poor Kerouac.
And you cannot drink or eat or...
Very difficult situation. So, I don't know, you're anything else to add about libraries?
No, nothing
else. And their inherent difficulties. And the book, anything you want to say about that?
The book, I'm not entirely sure if it appeals. I don't know. It sounds a bit like maybe hedonistic to me.
Well, other books of his, I haven't read any other book of his, but they seem to be a lot more hedonistic. I mean, The Road, for example, I think probably would fall into that category. This one, there's a few stuff at the, like, he goes on dates with different women, and then like he talks about like one woman in particular who was, well, he goes into, he doesn't go into details, but it's a bit saucy.
It sounds a bit like some kind of like older version of The Beach or something, you know.
Of The Beach.
Of the beach, yeah, the film with all the, like, you know, it's kind of like all, like, spiritual and all this, like, hedonistic stuff.
Spiritual and hedonistic.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually interesting. I heard an interesting theory about that we can maybe talk about.
Well, spiritual, I mean, Satori.
Satori, exactly. It's kind of an awakening thing.
Yes.
But I heard that actually it's a commentary as well on a matriarchal society, because the leader of the island is a woman. So,
and that came just now, no?
On that note, we'll go to part three. So, well, thank you for listening so far. Enjoy the music, and we'll be back momentarily. So welcome back to part three, the final part of this show. So Mary, we have some housekeeping to do. Can you tell us about Radio Public?
Please listen to us on Radio Public.
Thank you. No, continue.
No, if you listen there, you support what we do, but you can listen on any platform. We're on many platforms.
Wearing platform shoes.
Podcast platforms. Yeah. Just, you know.
All right, then. Well, thanks for giving me the hard sell. You can also find us on YouTube, our website, lrpmedia.com, Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, and our blog, irishslicemadrid.wordpress.com. And that's pretty much it. So tune in for another award-winning episode, or soon to be. I forget it. Just listen next week. good luck.
Bye.
The El Arpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.